Next case on our docket is Scott versus City of Mandeville. Mr. Whitmore?
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm David Whitmore here on behalf of the appellate, Amber Scott. I'm not here today to defend any poor decisions that Ms. Scott may have made the evening of this incident. If she were here today, she'd probably agree she made some bad decisions. If your car is not operating properly and you drive it with your children in it, that's a poor decision. You or I, we may choose not to take any sort of medication, prescription or over the counter, and operate a vehicle. But we're not here today to judge Ms. Scott's decision. We're here today to determine whether there was probable cause to arrest her for DWI and whether in effecting that arrest, the arresting officers used excessive force. Ms. Scott asserts that in granting summary judgment, the district court impermissibly weighed the evidence and made credibility determinations to reach its conclusion that the officers had probable cause to arrest her for DWI. As the district court noted in its decisions, Ms. Scott presented evidence that the arresting officers made inconsistent statements about their observations during their investigation. However, the court did not address these inconsistencies. Instead, it stated that even if there were inconsistency, there were other facts and circumstances that led to probable cause to arrest her for driving while intoxicated. So what were these other facts and circumstances? First, Judge Malazzo relied upon some statements made by a witness that Ms. Scott was driving erratically. Erratic driving may have given the officers cause to pull her over and further investigate. It may have been the basis for issuing a citation for careless operation, but standing alone, it does not give probable cause for an arrest for DWI. And it's our position that at the end of the day, as I'm going to analyze in just a second, that fact was standing alone at the end of the day, that she drove erratically.
Didn't an officer report that he saw her hit a curb?
Yes. Yes, I'm not disputing any of that. That did occur, and she did say I had some...
So we don't just have that fact standing alone then, do we?
That is a fact that...
That you had the report of the erratic driving.
Correct.
Then you had an officer who said he saw her hit a curb. So we don't have the one fact standing alone, do we?
Well, those are two facts, but they're all about the same thing. They're all related to her erratic driving.
All right.
So let's say that put it that way. Another factor that the court noted in support of her other facts and circumstances was that Ms. Scott refused a urinalysis. While the urine test may have shown she took her prescription medications, nobody's going to give her a urine test out on the street, and that's where she was arrested. The refusal to take a urine test came after the fact, after the arrest. That cannot form a basis for probable cause at the scene when she was arrested. Another factor that swayed Judge Malazzo is that Ms. Scott admitted taking prescription medications. That, again, was something she admitted at the station, after the fact, after she was arrested. That cannot form a basis for probable cause. So what are we left with other than the erratic driving? We're left with the observations of the arresting officers during their testing. Officer Guillory with Mandeville Police Department.
Well, and the observations of the erratic driving, such as hitting the curbs.
Correct. I'm not disputing that. You are correct, Your Honor. That is one of the observations, that she hit a curb. So what are the other observations? It's the testing. Officer Guillory said she passed all her stuff, but he called in Officer Huff. Judge Malazzo asserted that the plaintiff did not dispute the assertions by the defendant's officers that Ms. Scott demonstrated lack of convergence and swaying during testing. That's correct. I cannot dispute what Officer Huff said he observed. There's no video of the test. You can't get a camera focused on somebody during the testing anyway to see what's going on with their eyes, the lack of convergence and things like that. We don't have that. So I have to see what he said And we can attack what he said and create doubt as to what he said. And we think Ms. Scott demonstrated that there were serious issues with Officer Huff's credibility as well as with Officer Huff's Guillory's credibility. The court focused on lack of convergence and swaying and used that to support probable cause, but then turned a blind eye to other matters about the inconsistent statements. And one of those that she criticized Ms. Scott for raising was this nystagmus. The second paragraph of Officer Huff's report at page 325 contains a lot about what he said he observed about nystagmus. This report was completed 2 days after the arrest, and it's belied by statements that Officer Huff made on the videos, on the audios, at the screen, at the scene. In one of the videos, Don DeVille 4 at the 38-second mark, Officer Huff discusses lack of conversion at length with Officer Guillory, and Officer Guillory states, as he did many times that night, he didn't observe any nystagmus. At the scene, Officer Huff agreed. It's clear he said no. Clearly, that's what he said. He said no, but there was lack of convergence. He didn't say anything else about nystagmus. The inconsistencies and credibility of the arresting officers continued at the station. There's a booking chair video in the record, and at the 3:54 mark, there's an exchange again between Officer Guillory and Officer Huff, and Officer Guillory again says, I didn't see any nystagmus. And this time they're talking about prior to 45 degrees. But Officer Huff says, oh, I saw it. Just put it all in there. And you know what? Officer Guillory, despite the fact that he didn't observe any nystagmus, Officer Huff was not his supervisor, and Officer Guillory was the arresting officer, he did just that. He put it all in there, meaning in his arrest citation. The arrest citation was completed. It's page 419 to 422 in the record. On the first page, Officer Guillory says he is making the statements therein duly sworn upon his oath. On the second page, despite his assertions that he didn't observe any nystagmus, he did what Officer Huff told him to do. Under his own oath, and despite his own observations, he put it all in there. He put that she had all sort of nystagmus.
Did Ms. Scott testify by deposition?
No, Your Honor.
Because I mean, normally when we talk about a dispute of material fact, you know, the plaintiff says the traffic light was green and the defendant says the traffic light was red, and so there's a dispute as to whether the light was red or green. I understand that's not your facts here, but normally just inconsistencies on the part of one party doesn't necessarily create a dispute of material fact. Does my question make sense? We don't have here the plaintiff directly saying, no, what the officer said at the scene was false or inaccurate.
No. Well, first of all, Ms. Scott, if we're talking about the testing that they did, Ms. Scott can't look into her own eyes. She can't tell whether she has nystagmus. She can't tell whether she has a lack of convergence. What we have to do is take the inconsistencies, and it's not just inconsistencies. That's the word that I think Judge Malazzo used. It's the credibility. What I'm saying here is that Officer Guillory, even though he didn't observe any nystagmus, he swore out an arrest affidavit saying that he did. So what we have here is the old adage, falsus in uno, falsus in omnibus. If you're going to have two factors that the court relied upon, lack of convergence and swaying, and then there's this third factor that we raised, nystagmus, and we show that the things that the officer said were not credible and that he made a false statement. He didn't observe nystagmus, made a false statement under oath in an arrest citation. That's something that the jury should be allowed to determine whether they're telling the truth. Because if one falls, they can all fall. So that's where we believe the judge made a mistake in weighing the evidence and going to credibility. And I'd also invite you to watch the tape. There's a tape, the booking room tape at the 541 mark. Officer Huff suddenly notices that there's a camera in the room, and he goes, oh, there's a camera. And he looks at Officer Giller, and they say, oh, they didn't see anything. And they said, oh, that's right. They're not going to see expletive. If you're not doing anything wrong, why are you worried that there's a camera in the room observing you at the time? Those are things the jury should have been allowed to consider. The second issue Ms. Scott raises is about excessive force. In regard to this claim, the court said that the officers were gentle and cordial and didn't use anything that a juror could find represented excessive force. The video shows differently. The video shows one of Ms. Scott's arms being pulled behind her back and thrust up toward her shoulders after she advised the officers that she had had shoulder surgery. In the process of doing that, they also bent her over the trunk of the car from a standing position. It was anything but gentle. The court cited Rodriguez versus Farrell for the proposition that minimal force against a fragile arrestee which results in minimal injury does not give rise to a claim of excessive force. But this court's decision, that's an 11th Circuit decision, this court's decision in Johnson versus Holland, 710 FedEx 248, recognized that even when the court emphasized that there was a standard technique used, even when there's a standard technique of handcuffing is used, Johnson recognized that there could be a claim of excessive force when the surrounding circumstances would put a reasonable officer on notice that an arrestee was particularly susceptible to injury from the standard maneuver. The Johnson court noted that in Rodriguez, the officers had no notice that the plaintiff was vulnerable to an injury. In this case, Ms. Scott advised the officers, I've had surgery. She did it at least two times that she had this
But the video, which you've properly referred to a couple of times, shows that she was moving her arms, maybe even you might say waving her arms, but at least moving them around naturally. There's nothing in that video to indicate that she was in any way disabled or injured in such a way that her arms could not be used for a handcuff in the way any person's could.
I'm not saying that she was somehow disabled or unable to move her arms. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that when they then took her arm, took it behind her back, if you watch the tape, and then they thrust the arm up like this, that is where the injury occurred. And that gets us then into the things that Judge Malazzo didn't do, and that is to examine these factors from Graham versus Connor, as well as this court's decision in Bush versus Strain.
In connection with the injury, does the record contain any information about the nature or the extent of the injury that resulted from her arm being thrust upward behind her back?
Absolutely. We have a medical record in the evidence that talks about her injuries and says she's injured, she's hurt her shoulder, she's going to refer for an MRI, and she may need an orthopedic consultation. Yes, there's a medical record in the evidence.
So has she been receiving treatment for that?
She did receive treatment for that. The Johnson court, I'm sorry.
You do see the problem here. If we, let's say this was a 300-pound, very muscular, very fit male suspect who says, don't touch my arm, I've just had surgery. Don't touch me anywhere. I mean, what are officers supposed to do under those circumstances? But he says, but I'm not going to come peaceably.
I understand that that is what, and there's case law out there that says, and the appellee cited that say, oh, you know, anytime somebody don't want something to happen to them, they could say this. But that then gets, Your Honor, into the factors that the court did not consider, and that's the Graham versus Connor factors, that there was no analysis of that, of the factors by the district court, whether she poses an immediate threat, whether she's actively resisting arrest by attempting to evade, the severity of the crime. None of those factors were considered by the court. This court considered them as recently as just in May in Tucker versus Shreveport. They went through an analysis of these factors. There's no analysis of those factors in this case.
Well, it's pretty standard procedure to handcuff people so that they cannot reach for a weapon.
It is, that again gets into the analysis of the factors. in the Graham case. You have to analyze this under that. What kind of threat was she? There was no evidence that she was a threat in any way. And we're not saying that a standard handcuff of doing it like that, putting her hand, but to take it and then thrust it upward like that and bend her over the trunk of the car, those are the questions of fact that the jury should be allowed to consider. And I see I've run out of time, but we also have the state law claims, and the judge committed, in our estimation, many of the same errors on the state law claims in weighing the evidence and making credibility determinations. And we think she should have passed on that and allowed Ms. Scott to proceed in another form with those claims under state law. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Keith Detweiler. I'm here on behalf of the Mandeville defendants. Mr. Miller and I split the argument where I'm going to address the probable cause issue, and he's going to address the excessive force, if that's okay with the court. As to the argument that the officers gathered information after they got off of the scene, if the plaintiff's argument about learning about the drugs that Ms. Scott finally admitted to ingesting, or seeing that she was refusing a urinalysis, if that means that there's no probable cause for the arrest on the scene for a DWI, then every DWI where an officer who's trained in for the intoxilizer brings an arrestee in and gives them a breath test at the station, then all of those arrests for DWI would be negated based on that argument. In this situation, there was ample probable cause to arrest her for multiple violations. I think the officer showed restraint in not doing so. Counsel just argued that there may have been cause to arrest her for reckless operation. I suggest to you that there was. What they did arrest her for was improper lane usage. And you'll see in the video, Officer Guillory tells her when she finally realizes, because it took her a little while, she finally realizes that she is under arrest and she's going to jail. And he tells her on the scene, you are being arrested for improper lane usage. And he tells her that any traffic violation is an arrestable offense under Louisiana law. But then he tells her, you're being arrested for suspicion of DWI. And the suspicion is based on the collective 40 plus minutes of the investigation done on the scene, which included the two complainants, the civilians that called in and said that she was all over the road. She was causing them to fear for their lives, for her life. She was almost crossing the center line. She was
and her children were in the car.
I'm sorry?
Her children were in the car.
Yes, sir. There were three minor children in the vehicle, which again, you'll see on the video that she doesn't seem to acknowledge or worry about during this entire 40-minute process where the officers are trying to figure out what is impairing her. Lieutenant Ackman is the officer that initially stops her, and it's
well, and in terms of the video and who seemed to care about what did the officers do with regard to the three minor children who were in the car during the period of time that they had her on the side of the road testing her?
Well,
they didn't do anything regarding the children?
Well, they were next to the car, and they you could tell that they made sure that the children were okay seated in the back seat. What's telling is that the children don't seem upset when they're finally taken from the car, and Ms. Scott even says, with expletives involved,
I thought you were suggesting that she should have been trying to do something more with the children at the time she was also being tested by the officer.
No, what I'm suggesting is she doesn't seem upset about the fact that she has her children, and I think it's because of the level of intoxication that she did have because of the medications she was on. Throughout their interaction with her, they can tell that her speech is slurred and there's something wrong. Lieutenant Ackman is the first person that interacts with her and pulls her over, and it's all on his dash cam. You can hear what he says, and he says she's definitely impaired. And then when she gets out of the car, he questions her because she starts saying that her car is impaired, her car has problems and it pulls to the right. And then she starts talking about her surgery. And the surgery was something that she just brought up. So when he asks her about that, he starts questioning her about, well, if you had such serious surgery so recently, you have to be on pain medication. Because he's trying to get to the bottom of why she seems so impaired, and she denies it. She denies it repeatedly throughout. And so what the officers do collectively is try to figure out what the impairment is. They agree that alcohol is probably not going to be it. But when counsel says that she passed all of her field sobriety tests, that's simply not true. What Officer Guillory said was that because of the dim lighting, he couldn't tell whether or not nystagmus was an issue or not. Then he had her perform a series of other tests, which you can clearly see on the video. The 9-step test, she does poorly on the 9-step test. She has trouble as far as the counting. She's counting too fast. Those are all things that officers are trained to determine whether or not someone's impaired. And so everything she does from their simple interactions with her indicate to them that she's impaired in some way. And what they finally decide is to call in the drug recognition expert, Officer Huff, who Officer Guillory from Mandeville just happens to know that Officer Huff is on duty with the Causeway Police, so he calls him on the phone. And you can hear him clearly tell Officer Huff what he's got. He tells Officer at 1340 of video 4, which is Guillory's video and Guillory's audio, due to failing field sobriety tests, slurred speech, she denies she's on meds, definitely not alcohol. If it's anything, it is something he can't detect. Her pupils look fine, but there's bad lighting. So he didn't see the pupils drastically one way or another. So if he asked him, if you have time to come, can you come check this woman out? Because obviously she's impaired. So Officer Huff comes out. There are times on the video, they're on 190 in Mandeville. There are cars going by. You can hear some things, you can't hear other. There are multiple discussions between the officers where they're figuring out, they're doing their investigation as to probable cause. And whether or not what they have, what the situation is, you know, what they have or what's wrong with her. When they finally make the decision to arrest her, as I said, Officer Guillory tells her it's for improper lane usage and suspicion of DWI. He then brings her to the station. He sits her for a while. She's asking to take the breath test because she knows she doesn't have alcohol. And he tells her, you probably don't have alcohol, but I can't do it yet because he's got to wait the 15 minutes. So he does everything properly. When it's finally time for her to take the breath test, she does. It comes out zero. So then he explains to her, I'm going to ask you to take a urine test. She asks him all kinds of questions about what it's going to show. And he tells her, because now on the scene, you can see on the video where Lieutenant Ockman finds the prescription bottles of medication. There's 4 different bottles that he finds in the car. They involve Lexapro, Xanax, and hydrocodone. And there's one other. Well, now he knows that that's probably what she's on. So he tells her, if you take this urine test, if you're on those medications, and then she admits she's taken them at least twice that day, he tells her, then your urine test is probably going to show those things. And after 3 or 4 minutes of discussion, she says, I'm not taking that. So it's based on all of the totality of the circumstances, the suspicion of impairment on the scene, and then the investigations as it ensues. This is over a several hour period. And also based on the drug recognition expert, Officer Huff, that she's arrested for DWI and she's arrested for improper lane usage. So if you have any questions, that's all I have to say.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Burt Miller here on behalf of the Greater New Orleans Expressway Commission, Officer Huff and Nick Kajemi. I'm going to be addressing the excessive force issue, but there's something I would like to touch upon slightly on the false arrest claim, and that's just that one thing that wasn't mentioned earlier is qualified immunity, which is the applicable standard here. I think, and that's applicable to both the false arrest claim and the excessive force claim. And essentially, it's not that there can be no reasonable doubt about whether or not she might be able to be convicted at some point of a DWI. It's whether or not there was probable cause at the scene based on the facts and totality of the circumstances, and that the arrest was an objectively unreasonable. There's nothing objectively unreasonable per the video and the evidence presented about the probable cause that was present for the arrest. And Mr. Detweiler went through a number of the factors, and those were all there. She had lack of convergence at the scene. She had hit a curb, the children in the car. The officers spent a lot of time, and the court noted that the officers spent a lot of time trying to get this one right. And plaintiffs has pointed to inconsistencies during the progression of the investigation which do not obfuscate the probable cause that was objectively there for the arrest at the scene.
You need to spend your time on excessive force, I think.
As to the excessive force claim, one thing that has to be, well, the standard for excessive force, which is applicable to this case, and then the allegations are an injury, which is directly and only from the excessive force, which was excessive to the need at the time, and it has to be objectively unreasonable. We keep going back to the objectively unreasonable. And we have video of this that shows that Ms. Scott was handcuffed behind her back with her arm raised and kept in place to effectuate the cuffing by the officers. And one thing not mentioned was that Ms. Scott was not cooperating with the arrest. She immediately began to resist. Per the video, she began to resist the officer's attempts to put her in the handcuffs. And one case that I'd like to point out that was cited, it's a Poole versus Shreveport case, which was cited in the brief, 691 Federal 3rd, 624. It's a case that talks about excessive force and actions that escalate with the suspect's actions. It's measured and ascending action.
You don't disagree with the assertion that she told the officers that she had had surgery, and so that this was painful.
And Your Honor,
putting her arm behind the back, you don't disagree with that?
I don't disagree that she did say those words once the arrest began to be commenced. And we've also cited case law regarding this.
So would you agree with me that what may look like resisting is her refusing to put her arm in a position that causes pain, which is probably kind of natural? If you're putting my arm in a position that's painful to me, I'm going to resist putting my arm in that position.
Sure.
Agree with that?
I would agree that in general, that is potentially a reason for the initial resistance, but what has to be viewed regarding this inquiry is whether or not it was objectively unreasonable for the officer to take the action. Not subjectively unreasonable, objectively unreasonable. In what he knew at the scene, and I'm glad you brought that up about the issue of surgery and her statement. In the Johnson versus Hollins case, the one cited by plaintiff and brought up to this court, first off, that was an MSJ that was granted on the excessive force element for the defendant officers, because it was a de minimis injury and it was a normal cuffing. And that's what we have here. It's an ascending action with a normal cuffing. There was nothing objectively unreasonable or excessive about getting her into the handcuffs. It's standard procedure. There's cases we cited as well that say when you use the standard handcuffing procedure with, you know, in response to what the plaintiff or what the
suspect
is
doing. What is standard about lifting her arm up and putting her over the hood?
I'm sorry, repeat.
What is standard about lifting her arm up behind her back and putting her over the hood?
Well, so with the resistance met, obviously from the video, Officer Huff holds her arm. Once he gets her arm up, he holds it into place so that the other officer can actually lock in the cuffs, to put her in cuffs, and that is the standard part of it. It's standard for suspects to have their arms put behind their back in a position such that the officers are able to connect the handcuffs. That's the standard part of it. And with regard to the Johnson case...
But she's saying, don't touch my arm, it will hurt.
Correct, and that's the point I'm getting to. In the 11th Circuit case that we discussed, which was discussed both by the court and the plaintiffs, the Rodriguez case, this is a very similar case that was very applicable to the circumstances here. You had a gentleman who had an injury to his arm, and after commencement of the... And this case actually had a rehearing. So in the initial case of Rodriguez, There was no excessive force, and they didn't discuss the issue of him, of evidence suggesting that he told the officer he had an issue with his arm. On rehearing, they addressed that issue, and the rehearing is 294 Federal 3rd, 1276, I believe. It's also cited in our brief. And the statement about a prior injury at the moment of arrest does not defeat a claim of qualified immunity. We're not viewing this. This all has to be viewed from that auspice. And the Rodriguez case, there was evidence that after commencement of the handcuffing, the plaintiff had stated that, hold on, my arm's injured, and the officer continued to effectuate the arrest. One thing that that was also cited in that case is case law that recognizes that when someone's being arrested, they're not happy about it and they're going to say things, and especially after the arrest has commenced. And this is also cited in our brief, is that once the arrest has commenced, someone might say, don't do that, no, my arm, they stop, you know, whatever they're going to say. An officer doesn't have to give credence in the moment of arrest in attempting to do his job to place the suspect in handcuffs. And
well, I understand that, but there was nothing magical about that moment of arrest. I mean, they had spent half an hour or more with her. And so what would have been the problem with having a little more dialogue about the injury, the nature of the injury, when it occurred? All I'm saying is if she claims an injury and you're telling me the officer doesn't have to give credence to the claim, in that instance, where I mean, she's at the back of the car, she's doing every test they tell her to do, why don't you take 30 seconds and ask people
well, questions? And that's it. In the moment of arrest, it is kind of a special moment. Is now you've seized control of a person and you're trying to get them to cooperate with what you're doing and control.
I understand
that,
but there was no moment where she was out of where she was out of there.
Well, and you can hear and see from the video that as soon as like hands were placed on her arms, she turns and begins to fight all movements of the officers. And it wasn't just about her arm. She was turning, and you can hear that from the video from Officer Guillory saying, stop turning, stop turning, stop turning, you're pulling away from us, and he's trying to tell her to stop what she's doing and cooperate with the arrest. I mean, this is resisting their attempts to put her in handcuffs once they announced she was
in handcuffs. But if I'm resisting because it hurts.
Well, the turning wasn't necessarily, the turning was not, there's nothing to suggest that the turning was because it hurt. That came after when she said that, and in almost simultaneously, and really, with the movement to control her arm and be able to place it into the handcuffs. And the thing that the courts have recognized is that those moments where she screamed almost simultaneously with them putting her in the handcuffs, I had surgery, you know, an officer is not required, it's not objectively unreasonable to effectuate the arrest in that circumstance, even in the face of someone saying, oh, that hurts, or stop it. And that's what happened in the Rodriguez case. There was evidence to suggest that the person said, oh, you're hurting me by doing what, by moving the arms. And in that case, in the Rodriguez case, there was significant injury. In the Rodriguez case, the suspect's arm actually was amputated at a later time, allegedly, from the issues here. And I think the other important thing on that note to point out is something you mentioned earlier, is that the standard for excessive force that we're dealing with is injury directly and only from the excessive force, and it cannot be just de minimis. Well, when there's an exacerbation of a pre-existing injury, it's treated in the case law that we cited as somewhat of a de minimis. It's not directly and only from the excessive force used. She's already got this injury, and
do you know the nature and extent of the injury in this case?
As far as
the exacerbation,
and Your Honor, no, because there's no evidence submitted about the full extent of the nature, and we're here on a motion for summary judgment. And there's been no evidence to suggest the full extent and nature of this injury. We have one doctor's note that doesn't speak to the full nature of the injury or whether or not it was any more than de minimis. And I think that's the important part as far as the legal analysis. I think qualified immunity absolutely applies to both circumstances of false arrest and the excessive force claim. And for those reasons, it has to be viewed in that light, and there's nothing objectively unreasonable or clearly excessive that another officer would say, oh, absolutely, you violated her rights. That's the test, to look at it and say, oh, something went wrong here. That's not what happened, and it's clear from the video and the evidence. Thank you, Your Honors.
regard to the probable cause that Mr. Detweiler addressed, clearly, if you watch the tapes, Officer Guillory says she passed all of my tests, so I don't think she's impaired because of alcohol. She passed all my tests. He clearly says that. And the last time I checked, suspicion of DWI is not a crime that is in the books. So do you have probable cause to arrest for DWI or you don't? And if police officers arrested everybody in this state, we've all driven in the city of New Orleans, much less anywhere else. If they arrested everybody in this state for improper lane usage, we'd have a much worse problem in the city than we do okay now, because they wouldn't have time to do anything else. They'd be arresting everybody for improper lane usage. Excessive force, qualified immunity, those things were not addressed by the district court. Those things were not addressed in the briefs. But is it objectively unreasonable? Was their conduct objectively unreasonable? It's, to me, at least, it's objectively unreasonable to lie in a sworn arrest citation that you observed nystagmus. That's objectively unreasonable to me. Then we talked about the excessive force. There was no escalation. The turning away and the using the arm, that all occurred at the same time she was telling him, if you read the record, don't do that. My arm's hurt. I've had surgery. That's when she's, like you said, Judge Gray, she's kind of like saying, don't do that, please. That it wasn't this big resistance of a fight. I'm swinging at you. We're on the ground tussling or anything like that. It was just a little bit of movement like this. It wasn't anything to escalate. And then finally, they raised the issue of that the injury had to be from and only from this incident. There's a report in the record. I'm sorry I don't have it with me today, but there is a medical report in the record that has the diagnoses of what she has. It's not a de minimis injury. It's not a de minimis injury when the doctor says, I think you're gonna need an MRI and an orthopedic consultation. That's beyond de minimis now. But in terms of resulting from and only from and some exacerbation of a pre-existing injury, that's Wells versus Bonner.
Well, this summary judgment was long after the arrest. I mean, did she have an MRI? Did she have an orthopedic consultation that showed, yes, there was an injury?
Yes, she did, but I don't know. I have to go back and look at the record.
Is that in the summary judgment record?
I don't have that information in front of me right now to see. I don't have the record to see if I put all that in or not. If it's in there, it's in there. If it's not, it's not. I did put in the medical report with the diagnosis at the time about what caused the injury. But this exacerbation, that was Wells versus Bonner, and that's been, and another case they relied upon from the Middle District was Thomas versus Galata. Those are cases that relied upon, that's a case that relied upon Wells versus Bonner. But that Wells versus Bonner holding that you exacerbation of a pre-existing injury can't give rise to an excessive force claim, that was rejected by this court in Dunn versus Dank, and recently in 2017 in Windham versus Harris County at 513 Fed 3rd 492. So those are not applicable. That issue is not, the exacerbation of a pre-existing injury not giving rise to excessive force is not applicable to this case. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. That will conclude the arguments for today. The court